This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. California, the Fast Recovery Act, short for Fast Food Accountability and Standards Recovery Act. I welcome Professor Richard Epstein, a senior fellow of the Hoover Institution in California. He also teaches law at NYU and the University of Chicago, to comment on the governor endorsing the California Fast Recovery Act and what it means. Richard, a very good evening to you. Gavin Newsom celebrates the power that this puts in his hands and in his administration hands to raise the minimum wage for fast food workers from $15 to $22 per hour, mandating. I want to start right there. Does the state of California have the authority to do this? And what does it derive that authority to mandate what private employers must pay? Good evening to you.
Hi. Well, I mean, the general argument about the minimum wage law was one that was settled a very long time ago during the constitutional crisis in the 1930s. Previous to that time, maximum hour laws and minimum wage laws were thought to be an interference with the freedom of contract that firms were entitled to have. That got reversed on the theory that the liberty of contract is illusory unless there's, quote, equality of bargaining power between the two sides. And that particular sentiment continues to run forward today. I regard it as arrant nonsense. The power that you have as a worker depends on the relatively scarcity of workers that you need. And so long as you can have the option to go elsewhere, it will keep wages up at a sensible competitive level. But that is not the current law today. The question that one asks is, does it mean that the minimum wage law can go as high as you like without any restriction? It's never been tested practically because what happens is it's an interest group politics game. Labor unions, for example, want to have a minimum wage that is above what ordinary non-union workers can get, so as to punish them, but below what it is that they can demand, given the fact that they have a union. So, and they do not want a $100 minimum wage any more than anybody else does. But as this thing starts to go higher and higher, it is going to raise some particular tension as to whether or not this thing is sufficiently high that it's going to make large numbers of firms unsustainable, at which point somebody may want to look at the document. I don't think it's a clean case, however, because the power of the governor is actually much worse than it sounds here, because this is not just a question of imposing minimum wage restrictions. The statute that gives him the power to appoint this council gives him the power to embed in that particular council the ability to examine without limitations all sorts of essential features about the ways in which these firms work. So what you may well see is an increase up to, perhaps even at $22. There's no obligation that they go that far. But when you throw in all the other collateral obligations, what you are doing in essentially is paying more and more money to get less and less service. Your administrative costs are going to start to go up. Your productivity is going to start to go down. And so this is a much more serious restriction than simply looking at the minimum wage provision in isolation would suggest. And if large numbers of firms start to go back powder and under, then you have the phenomenon of a conservative judiciary, much of which has been appointed by Donald Trump, intervening on the grounds that you cannot pass a statute which guarantees the bankruptcy of large numbers of firms in what would otherwise be a competitive industry by imposing onerous conditions on them. And the tack will be not only on the minimum wage component, but on the entire panoply of action. So that is one line of attack that can be raised in this particular case. And I can assure you there will probably be others as well.
The reporting you provide says that the law also reaches into work conditions, so-called findings of fact. It says that the industry, fast food sector, is, quote, rife with abuse on pay, benefits, job security, and much more. And suggests that the governor's endorsement and the legislature's act will provide a way of monitoring the conduct of franchisees in the state? Is that what they're imagining, a sort of franchise police?
Yeah, they're not imagining. They're basically what they're doing is these franchisees, whether they work for national companies or for local companies, are independent entrepreneurs. The way the system has always been developed is that the franchisor has a powerful interest in maintaining brand quality across all of its independent franchisees, and so is entitled to put various kinds of restrictions on the kind of dress people wear, the menus that they put together, and so forth. But it's also understood that you will never get an efficient franchisees unless they have the power to hire and fire and to pick the wages for their own workers. So when you put the restrictions on the particular franchisees, it's going to make their lives much more difficult. That in turn is going to put more pressure on the franchisors to give a more favorable deal to the franchisees. So the ripple effects will be that everybody is going to have to bear passing on one way or another from the adverse effects of this particular kind of legislation. So there's no question that the franchisees have standing. The question is whether or not they have any really effective voice inside the administrative structure, which is the other major problem here. And what you see is this is appointed by the governor. He has already put a huge sum on the fair scale by announcing that he is four square behind the workers. He gets to put a commission together of 10 people, eight of whom he gets to appoint, no questions asked, two of whom are employee advocates without any particular role in the situation. And if he can control the appointment process without a confirmation check, without an industry check, without any kind of check, what you're going to see is a much more likely juggernaut than you would see if the members of this particular panel, a very bad device in general, are appointed by independent groups who actually have a stake in this. But if he gets to figure out who's going to be the employer representative, he could find the friendliest guy in town to do that job for him. And so he could get unanimous decisions in a way that is simply inimical to the position of the groups they're supposed to represent. One way to put this is there's another round of what we call separation of powers objection. You look at this statute, what the legislature has transferred over this broad area is, in fact, the power to make the law governing all of these cases. There's no limitation on the nature of the delegated power, no limitations on the nature of the appointed power. You put these things in tandem, and you will have a serious challenge based upon the fact that this is an illicit transfer of legislative power to the governor. I actually think that this ought to win. There is now in the Supreme Court much more interest in separation of powers and the delegation doctrine or the non-delegation doctrine. So it's not at all clear that this thing could survive that kind of challenge. But the industry groups have to be very astute in the way in which they bring it.
Let's speak of the industry groups. I follow your reporting. The bill shifts gears by extending its cover to some 16,753 local franchise locations owned and operated by 5,820 franchisees, all part of national chains with more than 100 or more establishments, even if only a small fraction of the outlets are within the state. Does that mean this legislation would go towards not only policing the franchisee in California, but the franchisor, the national franchisor as well, if those standards are not kept?
Well, this is a debated point. What happened is the original bill did contain a provision which said that the franchisor is liable for the sins of the franchisee. That provision was excised from the statute. The question that remains is, even if you pulled it out as an explicit check that they had on the franchisor, what is going to happen in these particular cases if this administrative body of 10 people decides that under some circumstances, at least, these rife abuse kinds of allegations require that the franchisor be roped in? There will be a question as to whether or not you can do this under this particular statute with that authorization. It's going to be a close question. And then there's going to be another difficult question and so forth, which is to the extent to which national labor law is going to stop this from happening. And the way in which the system works in the United States is whenever you're talking about union-related issues, and some of these will surely be that union-related or work or employer-related interest, is the National Labor Relations Act takes over. And it has a consistent policy which says franchisors cannot be held liable for the sins of their franchisees. It's going to be a real question as to whether or not this particular thing can be overridden by this state administrative agency. We don't know the answer to this question. We do know that both the Obama administration and the Biden administration would like to take that step, which would mean, in effect, the end of the franchise system, because you cannot have a large franchisor like McDonald's or Wendy's, whatever it is, having all these franchisees who do whatever they can to run their own business. And then what they find out is they commit a violation of the labor law as construed by a very pro-union administration. Now, if there's vicarious liability, the employer of the franchisor is going to have to answer for that. This means the employer is going to have to put greater control over the franchisees. The moment you put greater control over the franchisees, it turns out that they cannot work efficiently as a separate entity. And so the whole system could blow up. These people are playing with fire. They don't understand how fragile this system is on the one hand and how successful the system is on the other. And they seem to think that they can keep all the stuff that they like by getting rid of all, while they get rid of all the stuff that they don't like. But this is going to be extremely difficult. People have constantly reminded me, and I think it's worth mentioning now again, is there's already been a substantial move to the use of robots and self-sufficient devices so as to minimize the labor cost. Capital improvements of this sort, the substitution of equipment for people in checkout and ordering and so forth, is likely to start taking place, making this look more like an automat and then an old franchise. It's going to be less efficient than the old system, but it's going to be more efficient, I fear, than the new system, in which it makes it impossible to employ labor in sufficient quantity. I might add, I go into some of these franchises myself, and I really feel the generation gap. I watch younger people who've grown up with this kind of technology punch away at all these buttons and seem to know exactly what they're doing. I go to the same machines, look at them, have no idea what I'm supposed to press first, and always try to find my way to the nearest line where I could talk to a human being. This is going to affect, in many ways, very seriously, older people, particularly those with disabilities and so forth, who have to try to rely upon this system. They're just not as good at the mechanical stuff as the younger people who've grown up with this. So it's going to create all the kinds of
In other words, the franchisees are immediately going to discover that robots are the way around these restrictions. Richard, there might be another solution for the franchisees. Unionize, right? Isn't that what the whole effort here is?
Yes, that's what they're saying. We will excuse you from this if you go to a union. And that's probably flatly illegal under the National Labor Relations Act. The Section 7 rights, which were originally with a right to just join a union and under the Wagner Act, was modified with the Taft-Hartley Act in 1947. So it says you have the right to join and not to join a union. And that means, in effect, that the state puts its thumb on the scale, saying it's much more sensible for you to recognize a union, and that's going to change the relative balance. The unions are going to say this is not limiting the choice of the workers, it's only limiting the choice of the franchisee. But the answer is the moment the franchisee decides to capitulate, he's not going to fight the union. It's going to increase the likelihood of union representation. So I think, in fact, the provision ought to be struck down. We don't know who's going to bring the lawsuit. There's always a standing problem. My view is that a franchisee certainly has a right to bring this, and any worker who doesn't want to be a member of the union probably has the right to do it as well. But the entire argument here is, look, we know employers think that unions are a very bad thing. All the liberal guys who run franchises, whether they're running Starbucks or anything else, the C-suite, as they like to call it, these people understand that a union is bad news. It's not just the wage increases, it's the working condition. Well, this statute basically says you get that same poison either way. Either you can negotiate working conditions with a union, or you're going to have them imposed upon you by this 10-member board, all which is controlled by the governor. So either way, you're in deep trouble. The net effect is there probably would be, if the statute is allowed to go into effect, an increase in unions, a reduction in the number of employees, an increase in the number of robots, a sharp increase in the price, and a general withering away, or at least effective reduction of this industry. This is California trying to impoverish itself, and they may well succeed.
And I mentioned that Governor Gavin Newsom is a major political figure for the present and the future.
This guy's got presidential ambitions, obviously, and this is the program on which he's going to run. It's a major national challenge. A union is essentially a failed form of social organization in terms of its ability to deliver coherently to workers, and it depends heavily on being propped up by various kinds of
Well, it's a glimpse of the future conversation, Professor. Professor Richard Epstein of the Hoover Institution, a senior fellow commenting on the FAST Recovery Act, short for California, Fast Food Accountability and Standards Recovery Act. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Bash.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.